Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour, 25 more minutes of open lines. Then we'll be talking with Dr. Frank Beckwith about political correctness. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The question I've laid on the table in the last 25 minutes has to do with whether or not we ought to strike the holy shrine in Najaf, in the holy city of Najaf there in Iraq, well, where Muqtada al-Sadr, one of the bad guys of the week, he's got a little army over there, have been giving us some, well, he's been taking a lot of American lives and coalition lives over there. He's hiding out there. He's staying near that shrine, the Imam Ali shrine, and he thinks we're not going to strike him, should we? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dee's up, calling from her car. Dee, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, I'd just like to comment on that. I think as Christians that we have to be very careful and never do what the enemy expects us to do. And I can't believe that so many Christian people are saying that we should strike this. I think we also need to have respect for shrines in other countries. And just because, again, we have the power doesn't mean we need to use it. We need to use our wisdom. And perhaps outfight someone is not the way, but maybe outsmart them.
So what specifically should we do instead of striking the mosque? I mean, the if you're a military guy, you say, we know where he's at. There he is. He's thumbing his nose at us. Let's go get him. What would you do instead?
Well, sometimes I think that's the difference. I'm not a military guy, but I presume there are plenty of Christian military guys. And as a Christian military guy, I would still want to pray about it first, and I would say that that's exactly what the enemy expects, much like in David and Goliath, and that there must be another way, and that we should use our wisdom to look for that other way, which they would not be expecting at all.
So what do you envision? I mean, you're no military expert. I don't expect you to be one, Dee, but what do you envision as that alternative to taking care of business?
Well, I don't know, but that's what I'm suggesting, is that we need to look at other alternatives. For instance, when we've had hijackers, okay, and they've hijacked planes, and as ways to deal with that, there seems to be other ways to get someone out rather than completely doing exactly what the enemy expects. Because that, I think that's the only way we're going to throw the enemy off or even get them to listen, is to not do what they expect.
All right, Dee, thank you very much. I don't know if this enemy is going to listen. I mean, we're talking about terrorists here. We do have a policy of not negotiating with them at all. Okay, yeah, there are other ways of getting him out. I mean, we could wait until he steps outside for a smoke and we could try and nab him on the street. I mean, I'm being a little facetious here. We could somehow lure him away. See, he's in a no-lose situation from his perspective. I don't know what they expect us to do. Do you think the Muslims expect us to strike? I don't know if they do. Would he be hiding there if he expected us to strike there? Or maybe he does expect us to strike there, and what he's doing is simply saying, I'm happy to be a martyr for the cause. If they knock down this shrine and this holy site, it will forever stand as a monument both to me and to every bad thing I've ever said about Western powers. So either way, he wins. If we don't strike, he lives to fight another day. And if we do strike, he gets his ultimate goal, really, which is to make his point. Now, in the last half hour of Issues Etc., we are going to be talking with Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch, about whether or not we can negotiate with clerics like al-Sadr. We'll get his opinion there. And whether or not there are alternatives. There are two alternatives in my mind at this point. Either in some form, if we send troops into Najaf, we are desecrating their holy city. So unless we can fly over Najaf at a sufficient altitude and scoop him up, you know, where we said we weren't there, I don't know. I mean, to get him, we'd have to lure him out of the whole city, I guess. To avoid, in the mind of the Muslims, the Shiite Muslims, desecrating their holy city and their holy site. We'll talk about it in the last 25 minutes. Now, what did you hear preached on Easter Sunday? At the Cathedral of Life in Plain Township, Ohio, on Easter Sunday, well, they preached a sermon. The sermon had to do with the keys of death and hell. Jesus hold those keys, and character counts. And, you know, keys puts me in mind of my car keys, and my car keys put me in mind of, You know what would be a good thing to do on Easter? Give away a car. Give away a car. This church did have a car giveaway to boost church membership. We'll hear here from Pastor Dana Gammel. He says the promotion took an unexpected twist when a 9-year-old won the car that the church gave away on Easter Sunday.
I really didn't start out to give away a car, but it kind of became the emphasis of the sermon series. The series was on When Can I Have the Keys? Character Matters.
When Can I Have the Keys? Character Matters. Okay, so at the culmination of this sermon series, apparently they weren't doing Lent, but they did come to Easter with Jesus holding the keys of death and hell. Gammel says that the car giveaway was meant to illustrate God's gifts.
We began to think about how we could get more people to come to the church, as well as the fact that it would become part of the word picture or the illustration that we would use on Easter Sunday. The scripture talks about how that Jesus brought back the keys to death and hell and gave them to the church.
Okay, I guess I can see this requires some connecting of dots. Okay, here's the sermon series. When Can I Have the Keys? Character Matters. I imagine it's a series on character. And, you know, When Can I Have the Keys is what you often hear your kids say. They turn 15 and 16, they've got their permit, they want to drive. Dad, when can I have the keys? Well, in order for a kid to have the keys, you're going to have to demonstrate some strength of character, some responsibility. I think that was kind of the point. In fact, we'll hear a little bit more from Pastor Gammel on that point in just a minute. But so now Jesus holds the keys of death and hell. What better way to illustrate this, says the pastor down there in Ohio, across there in Ohio, I should say, than to give away a car? When can I have the keys? Car keys, you know. We'll give away a car. We'll boost attendance. Now, Pastor Gammel says the winner of the car, actually, when they won it, gave it away.
When we drew the name, it was a 9-year-old little girl, and we had said that if it was a child, the family could then decide what they wanted to do, or we could sell the car and put it in a scholarship fund for the child. Well, when the family came forward, and they had only been for 2 weeks, they had decided as a family that they wanted to give the car to the lady that invited them to the church.
So they'd only been coming for 2 weeks. Boom! Little Missy wins a car. Wow! Easter Sunday, they decided they want to give the car to the person who invited them to church. There's more to the story. Pastor Gammel says that the winner was obviously too young to drive.
The little 9-year-old said her and her family would like to give the car to someone else. And so then that lady came forward, and she began to weep. And then the congregation was so touched and moved, they began to come forward and lay money on the altar to give to the little girl. And they gave her around $575 because she exemplified such tremendous character herself.
All right, so remember the point here is character. Character matters, and this is the thing the pastor's been building up to in this sermon series that culminated on Easter Sunday with the giving away of the car, all working out beautifully. I mean, if you're asking for, you couldn't have coordinated something like this better if you would have planned it, and scripted it out. I mean, think of this is kind of Lifetime movie stuff. Little girl wins car. Little girl learns the lesson of the pastor's been talking about. Character matters. She exemplifies this character. She gives the car to the woman who invited her to church. Everyone walks up. They're giving money to the little girl because she exhibited such great character. All the lessons were learned from youngest to oldest. Finally, Pastor Gammel of Cathedral of Life says that the 9-year-old winner illustrated the Easter sermon about God's gifts. Listen carefully to what he says.
Sometimes he has things available to us, but we have to wait. And so it's a really neat way of saying that, yes, it's available to you. You just have to wait until that time. And she really proved that she was worthy of receiving it because she understood the value was in people and relationships.
You have to wait until you're worthy. God's got a lot of good stuff to give you. This was the message. Apparently, I mean, he says this is what the young girl illustrated so well for everyone, for one and all, as they learned their lesson on Easter. God's got all sorts of good gifts waiting for you, like a car that you win. But sometimes you have to wait until you're worthy to receive it. Is that how God deals with us? Does he wait until we're worthy to give us the good gifts that he gives us? How worthy are you of the things that God has given you? Let's just start with the simple things, the things we take for granted so often, which might raise the question whether or not you're worthy of them. How about your husband or your wife? Do you deserve them? I don't know how many people, men, women, I have heard say of their spouses on a regular basis, I don't deserve her. I don't deserve him. How about your kids? Yeah, my producer raises his hand. I can tell you for a fact he doesn't deserve the wife he's got or the kids he has. Do you deserve yours? Did God wait until you were worthy? Do you remember when the baby was born? Do you remember when your first child was born? Did God wait till you were ready for that baby? Did he wait until you were worthy of receiving that child as a gift? And this is the message of Easter at Cathedral of Life in Ohio. The little girl illustrated that, by golly, she was worthy of getting that car. This wasn't about free gifts. This was about waiting till you deserve it. And then when you deserve it, God will give it to you. I'll tell you two things, folks. I'm glad I don't have a God who waits until I deserve it or I'm worthy of it before he gives his gifts of grace freely. First and foremost, the gift of Jesus Christ and his forgiveness. Number two, I'm glad I don't have a pastor who preaches that kind of sermon on Sunday morning, or on Easter morning, or on any morning. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So what did you hear on Easter Sunday? Matt's calling from his car. Matt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I was just curious if you thought a lot more churches that are following the church growth seminars will start giving away cars if it brings in more parishioners. That's my only comment.
All right, thank you. Well, I don't know. If it brings them in. Now, I imagine they'll probably do what Pastor Gamble in Ohio did. He did his best to try and dovetail it with the basic message he had there, but look at what the message ended up being. This was Easter Sunday. A really good excuse to talk about, say, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, I don't know what he preached, but he said the message was. He might have preached about the resurrection of the Christ. But what he said the message was is God. He said it himself. You heard it. The little girl figured it out. She lived it out. Everyone saw it. The message was God has all sorts of good gifts for you, and you'll get them. You have to wait until you're worthy of them. Is that the message of the resurrection? Now, I'll tell you one thing. I've said this before last year when we talked about churches giving away cars at Easter. We did it last year. And, you know, every year there's going to be another story like this. If they really, 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 really care about the lost, then they should be giving away cars. Not just one or two, as many as they can afford, more than they can afford. Because apparently that's what it takes to bring someone to church nowadays. Even if it's a 9-year-old girl. And if the church doesn't have the funds to do this, they've all been praying the prayer of Jabez since the book came out every day for 30 days. God has, if they've been doing that, according to the book, has expanded their horizons. This dovetails beautifully with the purpose-driven life, too, because after all, what better way could you make God smile than to see to it that you get as many people in church as possible, and if it takes giving away cars? Look, if a used car salesman, if you turned on television at 1 o'clock in the morning and there was one of the typical used car salesmen doing his shtick on his commercial for you between reruns of The Cosby Show, and he said, Jesus brought back the keys of death and hell, and I have a pair of keys here for you. Look at this beauty. It's only $19.99, like new. Celebrate Easter and come down and buy yourself one of these cars. Jesus made you like new. Come on down and get this car. It's like new. He gives you the keys. I got the keys waiting for you. He waits till you deserve it. All you got to do to deserve this car is give me $19.99. That's all you got to give me, right? It's a perfect illustration. Now, you would turn it off. You would laugh. For some reason, the same theology at work in our pulpits on Easter Sunday of all times is considered a great life lesson to be learned by young and old alike. Darlene's calling from St. Louis. Darlene, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Pastor Wilkin, he is risen.
He is risen indeed, Darlene.
Amen. I am very saddened, Pastor, that any church, any church at all, would stoop to this level to give. Oh, man, the implications. It just saddens me so much that we got a church thinks they've got to give away a prize of any proportion.
You know,
whether it's a artificial flower or a $1 million house. I'm sorry.
Darlene, thank you for the call. I understand the depth of your sorrow here. I share it as well. I don't mind if churches give away cars. I really don't, but they should give them away to people who need cars. And just give them away. Don't say, hey, you finally exhibited the fact that you would deserve it, and that's why you want it. What was God guiding their drawing to the most deserving little 9-year-old girl? Or maybe to the girl who would understand the sermon message, God has all sorts of things in store for you that he will give to you as soon as you are worthy of it? Okay, if churches want to give away cars, fine. On two stipulations. One, if they remember that they have something far better to give away and they give it away free, it's called the forgiveness of sins. What good does it do anyone to be brought into church on the promise of a free car and to win that car and to walk away having heard the message that what God gives you, he gives you because he's finally decided you're worthy of it? They've taken the treasure, which is the free and full forgiveness of sins that is not earned, that is not deserved, of which no one is worthy, and they've traded it in like a used car salesman for a message that brings people in, but will eventually send them to hell. I just hope the lady who got this car and got this message drives safely until she can actually hear why it is God does give us the good gifts. All those gifts. Why does God give the undeserving and the unworthy his kindness and his mercy, his forgiveness, and all of the blessings of this life, body and soul? Why does he give us everything he gives us? He gives it all to us for the sake of Christ, because Christ won it all at the cross. Easter Sunday is a great time to proclaim that. The Christ resurrection from the dead now assures us that Christ lives to bestow the gifts of God upon the undeserving and the unworthy and the ungrateful. I even think there's a Bible passage about that someplace. Not that he waits until you deserve it. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I do know one thing. The church has been, and if you're going to give away a car, if you're going to give away a car to bring people in, give them the true treasure of the church, the forgiveness of sins, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the message of God's grace towards sinners who don't deserve it, in the perfect life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And if you're going to give away a car, don't rob people of that message by telling them that somehow this is a good illustration of how God deals with us. He waits until we deserve or are worthy of what he gives us. I hope that pastor's wrong. I hope that little 9-year-old girl, I hope that's not the message she got from the sermon. Tom's calling from Wood River. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling in response to your subject there. I think it's just a symptom of the legalism that's abounding in the church today, and men have forgotten, even reputable pastors, that, you know, Christ said, none is good except God. Paul said, none's righteous, no, not one, none understands, none seek after God. And teaching this little girl that she has to be worthy to receive God's gift, this eventually can only bring despair, because there's nothing we can do God gives us all things freely through whom he delivered up. And I just think it's sad because it's becoming rampant in the church, legalism. And you just wonder what to do about it. I mean, men do not understand the profound depth of God's grace, and that is totally something that is unmerited. It's nothing we can earn, nothing we can do to please God. Otherwise, Christ wouldn't have had to suffer so emphatically for us and die for our sins.
Tom, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
You use the term legalism, and you couldn't be any more right than you are. But I'll tell you what. That pastor would never say he's a legalist. No. Oh, no, I'm not a legalist. Legalists are those people who talk about God's demand for perfect obedience, things like that. I'm not a legalist. All I say is, the pastor would say, I'm not a legalist. All I'm saying is that God waits until you're worthy before he gives you the good gifts he has, which doesn't make them gifts, after all. I think Paul has something to say about, for the one who works, it's not counted as a gift, but as wages. The one who works and gets it because he works earned it. But the one who does not work but trusts God, who calls the unrighteous righteous, Paul says, that's not earned. That's grace. You know what makes me sad, and I agree with Tom and Darlene as well, what makes me sad is that even on Easter Sunday, there are churches that can't get it right. That even on the Sunday when you are likely to have more people in church who aren't often in church than any other Sunday, perhaps except for maybe Easter. No, Easter's the biggest. It's got to be. More than Christmas Eve. People don't go to church on Christmas Day anymore. Easter, the Sunday upon which you're going to have more people who seldom darken the door of the church. You can't even get the way God deals with us according to his mercy in Christ. Can't even get that straight. Got to mess that up. Got to inject somehow. Well, you know, say to that little girl, you deserved it. God saw that you were worthy of it, and so he gave it to you. You waited. You only had to wait 9 years. That other woman, you gave her the car. She had to wait a lot longer. It took her longer to get worthy of the gift that God gave her through you. What if I were to say to my children, I mean, think about this. If I were to say to my kids when they graduate from high school, you know, I feel pretty justified in loving you all these years because you finally proved you're worthy of it. How would you feel if your parents said that to you when you graduated from high school? Son, daughter, I'm glad I fed you and took care of you and gave you a bed and a roof over your head and paid for all the things that you needed. And I'm glad that I saw to it that you were well-educated and healthy and happy and well-rounded. And I'm glad I did all those things for you because finally you've shown me that you're worthy of it. I knew sooner or later you'd prove you're worthy of all I've done for you. You know what you would be telling your child if you said that? You'd be telling your child that you don't love them. We don't love our children because they deserve it. That's not love. God does not love us because we deserve it. He doesn't give us anything because we deserve it. He gives it to us because Christ earned it for us. We don't deserve it. Christ does. It's ours in Christ. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Perhaps St. Peter is best known for his greatest sin, denying Jesus Christ 3 times. But the story of St. Peter is really the story of God's grace in Jesus Christ. It's really the story of every Christian. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is called Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. It's the story of God's grace shown to St. Peter in Jesus Christ our Savior. This children's book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. It's our book of the month for March. Follow me, Peter Lays Down His Net, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Leaked reports say the government may be considering restrictions on over-the-counter sales of so-called emergency contraceptives. Stuart Shepard asked pro-life experts if that's good news or just political posturing.
Published reports say the FDA and the distributor of Plan B have been discussing whether to set a minimum age for purchase and if the drug should be kept behind the counter so pharmacists can monitor who gets it.
If certainly it is true that the FDA is considering restrictions on Plan B, the so-called morning after pill, that's a step in the right direction.
Kerry Gordon Earle with Focus on the Family says there are sound medical reasons for limiting sale to minors.
When it comes to setting some limits on the age at which a woman can buy this, that's a good idea because there are serious concerns about adolescents and their developing bodies and what repeated use of this drug would do to them.
She also strongly points out the drug sometimes acts as an abortifacient. Thomas Glessner is with the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates.
And so whether those are behind the counter or hidden from a young girl's view or there's an age requirement, it's still the fact that it's a drug that is an abortifacient and takes life. That's unacceptable.
He's skeptical of the motive behind leaked reports of a possible compromise.
Sounds like it's just a ploy to make it sound more reasonable that there's some type of protection for minor children involved here. But the fact of the matter is it's going to be distributed to virtually anybody who wants it.
He says there is no reasonable compromise on life. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
Emergency contraception can operate in one of three ways. It can prevent ovulation, it can prevent fertilization, and in some cases, can also prevent the implantation of a fertilized egg, essentially a chemical abortion. An FDA panel voted in December to make the drug available over the counter. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Next time on the Bible study, we have an opportunity to talk about a remarkable experience shared by Jesus and his followers, and that is the transfiguration of Jesus. We'll talk about it with Pastor John Schmidtke. He is pastor at Bethlehem Lutheran Church in St. Louis. Mark chapter 9 is the text on the Bible study next time.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's
people. How does worship heal anxiety, guilt, loneliness, and grief? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April deals with worship and healing. It's titled, They Will See His Face. You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Or you can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. The title of the book, They Will See His Face.
You know it when you see it. You know it when you hear it. And it's all around us, isn't it? On television, in the news, when you talk to your neighbor. You go onto the college campus, there it is in spades. Political correctness. We know it when we see it. We know it when we hear it. It is all around us. But what is it? And where did it come from? We're going to be talking about political correctness during this hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. Frank Beckwith will join us as our guest. He has written a chapter in the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, which he co-authored with Greg Kokel. One of the chapters there, Relativism's Offspring, Political Correctness, and Multiculturalism. Multiculturalism, that is a kissing cousin of political correctness, but we need to make the distinction there. Okay, so we know it when we see it, we know it when we hear it, but where did it come from and what is it? Dr. Frank Beckwith is Associate Professor of Church-State Studies and Associate Director of the Institute for Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. If you'd like to join us, our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727, and we have that live in-studio email address. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. It's now modern parlance to talk about PC. There was even a program. Bill Meyer had the show Politically Incorrect, which many people observed was probably the most inappropriately named program ever. In an attempt to be politically incorrect, he often came off being very politically correct. Or maybe that's just my perspective. You see, there are critics to political correctness, both on the right and the left. Many on the left look at people on the right and they say, well, they have their own political correctness. They have their speech codes, their thought codes, their idea codes that they all abide by. And of course, people on the right look at the left and say exactly the same thing. Where did it come from? And why is it so pervasive in our society today? Political correctness. 1-800-730-2727 or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I remember when I first came across it, it was actually in college. Now, this was some time back and probably in the beginning days of political correctness. Instead of talking about male and female, boys and girls, we started talking in language that was more gender inclusive. The student handbook was changed slightly, just a few words. Then I noticed it a little later when I was in the seminary, not in the student handbook, but this time in new translations of the Bible that had gender inclusive language. But it's not just a gender thing. We have departments, entire departments at universities and colleges that are dedicated to teaching the tenets of political correctness under the guise of things like multiculturalism, women's studies. If you walk into a literature class, will you be reading the classics of Western literature? Although you go to a university that has inherited the classics of Western literature, or will you be reading obscure writers of different genders and religion and cultures because it would narrow your view to read the classics? Is politically correct really correct? What does it have to do with truth? Does it acknowledge truth, objective truth? Or is that really the Achilles heel of political correctness? I invite your thoughts and your comments on it as we talk with Dr. Frank Beckwith, who will join us here in just a moment. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Now we see it everywhere. You turn on the television, you watch the news, and you say to yourself, well, that's so politically correct. It's become an epithet. It's become an insult. No one wants to be called politically correct, but there is such a thing. We're going to be talking about it during this hour. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Church-State Studies and Associate Director of the Institute for Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He's co-authored the book, as I mentioned before, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air, and he's author of Another Politically Correct Death. Frank, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Let's give a thumbnail definition of political correctness, since we all know what it sounds like and what it looks like. What is it? How would you define it?
Boy, that's a good question. Political correctness, I mean, in a nutshell, you could say is a particular orthodoxy that one finds at universities and colleges that says something about truth and community, but doesn't claim to say anything about truth and community. It's a paradoxical definition, because oftentimes the politically correct types will say things like, well, we believe in diversity, different points of view, et cetera, but what they really are trying to affirm is a particular point of view on their part. And typically, when we think of political correctness on college campuses, we think of it as a way to stifle debate. And yet, it usually tries to portray itself as a sort of openness point of view. But I think the best way is to define it as an orthodoxy. And what I mean by orthodoxy is a view of what is good, true, and beautiful. But what makes political correctness sort of ironic is that it claims not to be that.
It seems as though everyone, I'm going to make a very sweeping statement
here.
Everyone can sense the irony
of
political correctness, except those who practice it. They seem not to sense the irony.
That's right. I'm going to give you an illustration of this. I'm on a list listserv with a bunch of constitutional law professors around the country, and we discuss all sorts of topics, having religion and the law. And there's one fellow who continually defends what you and I would call political correctness, and he said just the other day, you know, the problem that I have with people like you, Beckwith, and a few others is that you believe you're right and everybody else is wrong. And for that reason, you are narrow-minded, and you know all the bad, you know, descriptions of wrong-headed people. And so I wrote him back, and I said, "Do you think that you're right about us?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, then you're in precisely the same position as me. You think you're right, and I'm wrong," which, of course, you said was a vice. And he wrote me back, and he said, "Well, I'm not saying that at all." And as I continually tried to pin him down, he would shift and say, "Well, I'm not claiming to be right." And I would say, "Well, then why are you correcting me?" And this continually goes on, I think, with the politically correct types. They don't think they're really affirming something, or if they do, they don't really understand it. And their criticism is that other people are dogmatic, and yet they offer a whole set of dogmas.
Where do you see political correctness having its greatest currency in American society today?
I think mostly, I think in two places in particular. One, in the academic world, especially in universities and colleges. Secondly, I see it in some parts of the business world, where major corporations, for example, they don't want to offend people or to get people angry, and so they oftentimes require the employees to engage in or attend classes for diversity training. Now, in principle, there's nothing wrong with that. I believe that, and I think all good Christians should believe that we should treat people with respect and dignity and kindness, regardless of who they are. But what goes on oftentimes in these diversity training programs is a particular view of what counts as the moral life, and a requirement that people who have Christian sensibilities be silent. So, for instance, people will be taught that it's wrong to criticize homosexuality. It's wrong to make critical comments of one's sexual orientation. And yet, in order for the diversity trainer to make that statement, he has to imply that traditional Christian, Jewish, and Muslim understanding of sexuality is mistaken. So, you know, in the name of openness, what it does, it's sort of silencing people and making them feel awkward and odd about holding traditional views on, for example, human sexuality.
Most people first encountered political correctness, not in the classroom or even watching television. Most of them encountered it with the way the speech codes of political correctness found their way into modern parlance. Black became African American, then all other ethnic groups started picking up on this. Certain words didn't just go out of style, they became foreboden.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there's even some silly versions of this. One, I think, I don't even know if this is actually true or not, but it may very well be, but that people that are bald should be called follically challenged rather than bald. People shouldn't be called short, they should be called vertically challenged, and things of that sort. I mean, on one level, I mean, you can understand why somebody would not want to be called a name that they think is insulting or disparaging. But it seems to me to be rather selective. For example, nobody hesitates issuing judgments against Christians by calling them narrow-minded fundamentalists. And yet, you know, I've never heard, what's the politically correct word for that? It seems to me sort of one-sided, that only certain select individuals and groups are accorded this respect. And so I doubt, there's a part of me that doubts the sincerity a lot of this, although I do think that in some cases, you know, people may very well want to be called certain things because they think it's appropriate, and they have that right to do that. I don't dispute that, but I do think it sometimes is used on college campuses to as a hammer to silence people. I mean, several years ago, there was a fellow at the University of Pennsylvania who he was a student trying to study one evening, and there were a group of girls or young women outside his window playing some sort of game, and they were talking rather loud, and so he yelled out the window without even having looked at them. He said, "Shut up, you water buffaloes." And this, you know, the girls turned out to be African-American, but apparently he didn't know that, and so they filed charges against him for violating the speech code, and he was almost kicked out of the University of Pennsylvania. Although, I mean, there's good reasons why he probably shouldn't have called them names, but it seems to me that to issue the claim that someone's a racist so easily without, you know, I assume that people are of goodwill. I don't assume that the worst of them when they, you know, say things. But this is what happened at Pennsylvania, where these students used the code as a type of hammer to humiliate and, you know, almost destroy this young man. And that's, I think that's inappropriate.
Where did political correctness as a kind of coherent way of looking at language, the world, education, ideas, where did it begin?
Boy, that's a good question. I think you could trace it back to a number of different philosophical schools of thought. One, and I'm not an expert in this area, but I've read a little bit on it, and that is the what is called the Frankfurt School, a way of looking at knowledge and politics that comes out of Germany and Austria, I believe in the 1920s and 1930s. And this was a time in which people were becoming skeptical of the ability of governments to, let me put it this way, they were skeptical of whether there were such things as rights, as we think of rights, like in the Declaration of Independence, and they wanted to look at politics as a wholly naturalistic enterprise. And so for that reason, all that mattered was power, being put in power. And so they understood that the best way to get power is to manipulate people through rhetoric and through the use of language and to marginalize people based on language rather than arguments. And that was the beginning of it. It was a way of looking at politics as simply might makes right. And it eventually found its way in the university through certain schools of thought in literature. The deconstructionist view of literature or interpreting literature was an attempt to undermine objective text. That is, the text would have objective meaning. And, of course, if that's the case, then things like rights and constitutions and so forth are simply at get their meaning at the whim of the powerful. And so part of it is, I think, can be traced back to this skepticism about language and knowledge and our understanding about ourselves. And I think Christians can clearly see the implications for that for the Christian worldview. We as Christians believe that the Bible is a text that has objective meaning. Any school of thought that in any way challenges that is I think, a hostile to the Christian worldview.
I wonder, before we get into kind of taking political correctness apart and playing out, teasing apart the threads of that irony that you mentioned before, that really is, that irony has its roots in just a basic, fundamentally flawed logic of political correctness. Before we get into that, it seems at the same time that political correctness has been trying to tighten the reins on speech, on thought, on ideas, at the same time, we've witnessed a coarsening of discourse in pop culture, in the media, that would it almost appears to be a backlash against political correctness.
Yes, it's interesting. Part of it is. This is sort of my attempt to account for this. I think part of it is that down deep people do have awareness of certain moral principles. And for that reason, they tend to react against things in popular culture that they find to be offensive and ultimately result in the coarsening of our culture. But they don't know how to precisely respond to it. Part of it is... I think that we sort of feel inhibited in responding to cultural things because we think, well, people accuse us of being censors and so forth. On the other hand, much of this, and I think you're correct, is sort of a reaction to sort of the rules that of political correctness. So there's an interesting dynamic going on in culture.
What is the relationship between political correctness and multiculturalism?
Good question. Well, it depends how you define multiculturalism. I in my book on relativism that I co-authored with Greg Kokel, I define multiculturalism in two ways. One is a type of weak multiculturalism, which I think is the sort that one finds, for example, in the New Testament. That is, that everyone is made in the image of God and that the gospel is accessible to people in all cultures, in all walks of life, all races, and both genders, that there is a sense in which our common humanity is what unites us on one level, and that because of that we are all flawed and fallen, but we can all come to Christ, and that we ought not to discriminate against people based on ethnic and cultural differences. On the other hand, multiculturalism, as it's found in a lot of universities and colleges, is much more than that. It's a type of relativism. That is, we shouldn't judge other cultures. Now, of course, once again, we have the ironic result of this is that these people do not hesitate in criticizing Western culture as being oppressive and evil and resulting in all sorts of injustices against people. And yet, in order to make the claim that there are injustices, that there's oppression, and that Western culture is wrong, is to claim that there is a way or a universal way to judge cultures, which, of course, would mean that not all cultures are equal. So this is, you know, the problem with this sort of reasoning. So I think as Christians we can embrace some form of multiculturalism, but it should not lead to relativism.
We're dealing here, it sounds like, either in the case of political correctness or multiculturalism, with a self-refuting claim.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
That's right. Self-refutation is when somebody offers a point of view that cannot consistently stand by its own standard. So, for example, if I were to say, I don't exist, well, obviously I would have to exist in order to say that, or I cannot say a word in English, or everything I say is false. Well, what about what I just said? Is that false? Those are self-refuting statements. One that I particularly like is the claim that my brother is an only child. That would be self-refuting as well.
So if I say there are no absolute truths or morals that exist, but each group, each community, culture, develops its own morals and standards, and all of these standards are completely conditioned by the culture which forms them, but they don't exist as universals that can be applied to everywhere at all, to everyone at all times.
Well, that itself becomes a universal standard. I mean, that's the problem. To say that there is no universal standard, but then to offer an account of different communities that applies to all of them is itself a universal standard, in itself refuting.
We're talking with Dr. Frank Beckwith, Associate Professor of Church-State Studies and Associate Director of the Institute for Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, about political correctness. If you'd like to join us, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Is this just a left or a right thing? Is this just left-wing, right-wing?
I think generally political correctness is attributed to the left, but the right can engage in political correctness as well. And in fact, much of the inspiration of political correctness, ironically, comes from writers that had been supportive of the Nazi regime in Germany, including Paul de Man, who was a literary critic and writer, as well as Martin Heidegger. So, it's not something that you can really pin down to left or right, but today it happens to be the left that is the most politically correct.
Is political correctness something that is here to stay, a real force of nature in the culture, or is it a waning fad?
I think it's a waning fad, and here's why. I'll tell you, from my experience with my students, they are so sick of political correctness. And when I'm in class and I'll sometimes let loose with some joke, or I will say things that are critical of the popular culture, I've had students come up to me and say, geez, I feel liberated that I can say these things in your class. And so I think that students, especially those that are undergraduates, are kind of tired of it. They don't like it. And I do think that there is a backlash against it, especially some of the films that have been coming out that are somewhat risque, but But they are still combating political correctness. And I think in an interesting sense, Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion, is also very much against political correctness. I mean, it's a statement about Jesus being the savior, and that's not politically correct in a culture that says you should not make religious judgments.
I want to talk about that when we come back from the break. When
sure.
When PC goes to church, some very strange things and some very strange Jesuses emerge from the church. And when we come back from this break, we're going to take apart the irony that almost everyone detects in political correctness. You know it when you see it. It has become something that is probably useful only for jokes, because everyone senses the irony in political correctness, the fact that it is self-refuting. But let's take that apart. How does it refute itself? How do the statements and the philosophies behind political correctness, how do they refute themselves? How are we to deal with this? How do you respond to an argument that precludes any claims of truth except its own? Frank talked about one of those when we started our conversation. Someone who says, well, the thing I can't stand about you is that you guys all think you're right. Well, do you think you're right? Yes. But that's not what I mean. Does political correctness rob us of the ability to think clearly? In other words, is it not just a problem of having your philosophy wrong, not having learned all your ABCs of proper thinking, but the inability to think as well? Before we go to the break, Frank, what do you think about political correctness having robbed us of our ability to think clearly or even make a cogent argument?
I think it robs us in this sense that some of us have opinions that we think are well thought out, but because the dominant culture is going to punish us if we dare to speak up, we hold back. And in what we do is we deny our fellow citizens an opportunity to hear an intelligent, winsome presentation of a view that may not be politically correct.
But the person who says something that is straight from the handbook of political correctness and does not see the illogic, like the person you were corresponding with via email, has it robbed them of the ability to think objectively about their own thoughts?
I think it reduces their thoughts to just a series of slogans. And this is why people can get away with things that ordinarily we wouldn't be able to get away with. Several years ago, when I was on a panel discussion on this at the Cal State Los Angeles in Southern California, the fellow on the panel was saying, diversity is a good thing. And I said, well, how do I know this is true? And I just started questioning him. I started being the skeptic. And he just said, well, everyone knows it's true. So I don't know it's true. Tell me why. And this is one that they're not accustomed to. They're accustomed to having their views put in place because people happen to agree with them that run things. And so I think that one of the neat things about political correctness in terms of what we as Christians can do is to simply play the part of the skeptic and start challenging it.
Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. We're talking about political correctness. I'd like to hear from you. Have you encountered political correctness? Give us a call during this break. 1-800-730-2727 and our live in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Frank Beckwith is co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, and he's authored the book also, Politically Correct Death. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.